I want to start today by telling a story that started me researching my most recent book. And some of you will recognize this, and you've surely been there. Many years ago, I took a tour of the Susan B. Anthony House in Rochester, New York. And the tour began here in the entryway, so here in the doorway. And there I learned some surprising things. The story began quite predictably, the tour guide began, with the story of Seneca Falls, as most 19th century women's rights stories do begin. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the story, I'll just quickly rehearse it. The idea is that in 1840, there was a World's Anti-Slavery Convention in London. The United States abolitionist community sent delegates to the World's Anti-Slavery Convention, which included male delegates and female delegates. Lucretia Mott was one of the people who'd been sent. She was a veteran abolitionist. And another young woman was there, a much more junior person, who was Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She was not there as an abolitionist delegate. She was there on her honeymoon. Her husband was an abolitionist. And as the story goes, there was a lot of opposition to the seating of the female delegates from the United States. There was a sense that women didn't belong on the convention floor. And so there was the convention was racked in the whole first day by debates over women's rights and whether women should be seated. And eventually they decided that women would not be seated on the floor. They could sit behind a bar and listen but not speak. And as the story goes, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was particularly outraged by this. She met Lucretia Mott, who she admired greatly, for the first time at this convention. And the two of them walked arm in arm around the streets of London with their indignation and vowed to hold a women's rights convention on their return to the United States. And then there's an 8-year gap in the story, which doesn't seem to trouble most people who tell the story. And then in 1848, Lucretia Mott is visiting Western New York. She's visiting her sister in Albany, New York. They pay a visit to Seneca Falls, where Elizabeth Cady Stanton has started a young family, and they have a tea party with some other women. They decide there and then that they will hold the Women's Rights Convention that they vowed to hold in 1840. They put an advertisement in the newspaper, and a few days later at the Wesleyan Chapel, about 300 people show up, and it's the very first Women's Rights Convention in the United States. That story is pretty canonical at this point, and it is always used to frame stories of 19th century women's rights. And what was unusual about my tour was not the telling of the story of Seneca Falls, but this sort of third person that my tour guide struggled to place in the story that she was telling, and that was Susan B. Anthony herself. This was, of course, Susan B. Anthony's house. And she explained to me that Susan B. Anthony had really wanted to be there at Seneca Falls in 1848, but that teaching duties tied her up and kept her away, and that her parents and her sister went in her place. Some of you probably already recognize the errors here. And I politely raised a question saying I didn't think Susan B. Anthony had known anything about Seneca Falls. And my tour guide assured me that she really wanted to be there, but that teaching duties kept her away. And there are two false parts of this equation, which some of you who know the story will recognize. Susan B. Anthony's family did not attend Seneca Falls in 1848 in July. They attended the follow-up convention in Rochester in August, a month later, a very, very different event. But those two events are often conflated, and I have more to say about that in my book. And there's absolutely no evidence that Susan B. Anthony knew anything or wanted about the Seneca Falls convention or wanted to be there. But what struck me was the strong need to somehow link Anthony to the Seneca Falls story. That if you're going to tell a story about 19th century women's rights, it's framed by the story of Seneca Falls. But the fact is inescapable that she had nothing to do with Seneca Falls. So why my tour guide's interest, which is really pervasive, to try to link her to Seneca Falls? And this is not unique to my tour guide at the Susan B. Anthony House. Surely some of you can tell familiar stories about people linking Anthony and the Seneca Falls story. It happens all the time. And this tour happened right at the time that I was beginning to question the narrative of Seneca Falls. And by this, I don't mean the veracity of the story. The convention clearly happened. But what I mean is its voraciousness, its ability to consume everything around it. Its ability to make itself a required element in any telling of 19th century women's rights. Here I was in the house of an incredibly complex historical actor who had a long life of activism that spanned, you know, many decades, who had nothing to do with Seneca Falls, and yet that was the frame used to recount the story of her life. It's an odd frame when you stop to think about it. So how on earth, I started to wonder, did Seneca Falls begin to have that kind of power, and when? And those questions sent me to researching my new book. So I do want to pause here before I start the sort of substance of my talk and just say a few words about the category myth. Because I do not mean here, and I explain this in the introduction to my book, to call Seneca Falls a falsity. The convention clearly happened, and I think there are lots of arguments that can be created about its importance. But any argument about its importance doesn't flow automatically from the convention itself. The convention happens, and then what that convention means is up to the people and the significance they assign to it after the fact. And events don't have inherent meaning. We know that as historians. So what I mean by myth in this context is a venerated and celebrated story that people use to give meaning to the world. And to call it a myth, then, and as I do in my book, is simply to acknowledge that it's an event as well as a story, and that the two are not one and the same. And I'm particularly interested in the function of origins myths, which Seneca Falls is, about a beginning. Origins myths, I'll just kind of go through here some of the ways in which they work, and then I'll map those ways onto the history itself, which I'll tell. Origins myth work to legitimate and unify messy contingencies. They make the outcome of the story appear unmanipulated, if not inevitable. An origins myth, once dominant, promotes the forgetting of the struggles within the struggle. And having won, that origins myth eventually appears to tell itself to be self-evidently true, as if it had always been meant to be. And that is, I'll show today, as partly how the story of Seneca Falls has worked. This is a central argument in my book. It's been a really important piece of the work of Seneca Falls, this hiding of the struggles within the struggles. And I think it has, in the end, clouded and even misdirected our understanding of 19th century women's rights. And this is a kind of tension, because at the same time, the story of Seneca Falls draws our attention to 19th century women's rights. But it draws our attention in a particular way that filters and tries to shape our understanding of that story in a way that I think sometimes can promote the forgetting of struggles within the struggle in a way that we're left with a kind of misapprehension about what happened in the 19th century. Seneca Falls is quite possibly the longest standing origin story ever produced by a US social movement. It continues to be a very important story today. And I think to query it is to finally grant the story the respect that it deserves, to acknowledge its significance, which is formidable. So what I want to talk about today and to outline is the origins of an origin story, as it were, drawn largely from the first chapter of my book. So if Seneca Falls, the convention, was an antebellum event, what I argue in my book is that Seneca Falls, the story, was a postbellum event. It originates in the postbellum years. Immediately after the Civil War, this story starts to be born in the late 1860s and early 1870s. So just so that people understand, in the antebellum period, Seneca Falls had no particular venerated status, and often it wasn't remembered at all, and I talk more about this in my book. But even after the war, it took a long time for the story of Seneca Falls to become accepted and to become a full-blown myth, something that was sort of told itself. And the substance of my book carefully unwraps that process, which doesn't really become complete until 1898, the close of my book, and 50 years after the event itself. But back to the story of the beginnings. To understand why this story came into existence, we need to look in basically two places. And the first is the intense memory wars that began following the Civil War. And the second are politics internal to the women's movement itself. And I want to spend my talk today fleshing out these two factors, showing how and why these particular developments encouraged some activists to try to start identifying a beginning for women's rights, something that simply didn't occupy antebellum activists, this question of beginnings. So, first, the first important context for understanding this, the burgeoning post-war memory culture. Perhaps at no other time in American history had Americans argued so vehemently about memory as they did after the American Civil War. The war had settled two things. The South would remain part of the Union, and chattel slavery was over. But it left unsettled many, many more things. How would the South rejoin the Union? What was the status of freed people? And at the heart of this matter was how to define freedom and how to rebuild the nation. And that fierce debate over competing definitions of freedom took place in the arena of memory. It wasn't the only arena, but it was a very, very important arena. Because freedom had no inherent self-evident meaning, Americans debated its definition by attempting to debate the past. In particular, they tried to answer one question about the past. Why had the Civil War been fought? And again, here what they're doing is looking back, not forward. Had it been fought, as freed people and abolitionists argued, for emancipation? If so, that required a post-war political response that validated the needs of freed people and invested freedom with significant weight. Or had it been fought, as white supremacists argued, for valor, honor, and states' rights? If so, that required a post-war response that elevated women's rights over the rights, elevated white Confederate rights over the rights of freed people whose knees were largely erased by such a memory, or had it been fought for a myriad of other reasons, all of which urged different responses in the present and the future. Remembering the war became a boom industry as America struggled to rebuild and govern a deeply divided nation. And memory wars, in turn, were a defining feature of politics for the remainder of the century, even for people who hadn't participated in the war. And this has all been really well documented by historians, particularly most notably by David Blight in his prize-winning 2001 book, Race and Reunion, The American Civil War and American Memory. But rarely, if ever, in those memory wars, which now occupy so much attention by historians, are women suffragists part of the equation, even though they were rebuilding their movement in precisely these years that memory wars were taking place. They're never treated as participants in those memory wars, and what I argue is emphatically they were. The myth of Seneca Falls, I argue, was emphatically a Civil War memory narrative, among other things. It was about the memory of the Civil War, a point that's easy to miss given that it seems at face value to be about the antebellum decades. But it was created to intervene in these national memory debates and in the process to argue for women's political rights as a defining element of meaningful freedom in the present and the future. Within this memory culture, what particularly spurs white women's rights activists to turn to memory as a political tool is the tenor of white abolitionist memories following the war. So, namely, the white male abolitionist penchant for self-congratulation following the war. This starts to really irk women's rights activists. They had all been allied prior to the war in a kind of abolitionist-feminist coalition. But after the war, abolitionists, being justly proud of the fact that emancipation had happened, begin to hold anniversary conventions to celebrate their victory, where they begin recounting their history. And it really, it's a history they're in the midst of writing and rewriting in the aftermath of victory. Those anniversary conventions offer a very glorified narrative, a kind of new and evolving narrative about white abolition. And that narrative goes something like this. It has three main elements. First, that they, the white abolitionists, had brought down slavery, which, of course, elides the contributions of freed people themselves and others. And that they, secondly, was suddenly all white and male. Or mostly white and male, but emphatically male, despite the robust and sustained contributions of women throughout the abolitionist movement. And white women begin starting to disrupt these abolitionist anniversaries, saying, why is this an all-male narrative that you're telling, and why are you not supporting women's rights? We were there too, and we also deserve reward. And then after 1869, when Congress passes the 15th Amendment, allowing freed men to vote, they begin also to argue, thirdly, that victory was complete. And that elides the continued injustices that African Americans faced, and it also elides the fact that black and white women still can't vote. So the victory in their mind is not complete at all. They find this whole narrative, white women's rights do, quite objectionable, white women's rights activists. But these anniversary and commemorative conventions that freed people and abolitionists start to hold are held by lots of different groups in this period. It's a period of commemoration, and there's all sorts of celebrations. And so soon, certain women's rights activists begin to understand that to compete in the present political climate, they too need deeds to commemorate. They needed their own history to wield in the service of their present and future political demands. So, not surprisingly, suffragists began holding their own commemorative conventions, centered on celebrating the movement's beginning. Suffragists hold their first commemorative convention, an anniversary celebration, in 1870, right as these memory wars are taking shape and right as the white abolitionist movement is starting to tell a narrative of its own triumph. And as this celebration takes shape, this 1870 celebration, it was clearly meant to take aim at these abolitionist narratives. That was clearly one of its goals. Beginning in 1869, white women suffragists began to advertise this second decade convention, and it was to be held in the fall of 1870. In October, 20 years earlier, reformers had assembled in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1850, and this was now the event that they proposed to celebrate. That 1850 convention in Worcester, Massachusetts had been the first national women's rights convention. Seneca Falls was a very local and small-scale event. There were other small-scale local conventions. And in 1850, all of those started to cohere into a kind of national whole. And some people use that to date the beginning of women's rights, when and if they were interested in that story. And one of the original organizers, Paulina Wright Davis, is responsible for organizing this commemorative convention. When the commemorative convention is advertised and takes shape, Paulina Wright Davis heralds it as the 20th anniversary of the inauguration of the women's suffrage movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton is there. She stands up, calls the meeting to order, she hosts it, and says, quote, "The 20th anniversary of the inauguration of women's suffrage is now in session." So Stanton, the ostensible mother of Seneca Falls, herself at this gathering instructs people, and she says elsewhere in the convention, the movement in England, as in America, may be dated from the first national convention held at Worcester. So we have an 1850 origins being proposed here. Davis then reads a lengthy historical overview of the campaign, which she would later publish and which is really the first written account of the women's rights movement. Davis and the convention organizers clearly meant by their account to take aim, as I said, at this white abolitionist narrative. They clearly meant to enter the memory wars by this convention. If white abolitionists had argued that the greatest movement for humanity ever launched was abolition, white women's rights activists countered. Davis was already on record opposing black men voting before white women, and she now opposed abolitionist memory claims by arguing that women's rights was actually more historic than anti-slavery. Right? The narrative going on is that anti-slavery is the most historic movement ever for women's rights, and women begin to counter. She says, for example, during her remarks, that 1850 birthed the women's rights movement, which she calls, quote, "the greatest movement for humanity ever inaugurated." And clearly that's meant to take aim at abolitionist narratives. So if the women's suffrage movement was the greatest movement for humanity ever inaugurated, if that memory of the past is true, then present politics demand the prioritization of sexual equality over racial justice. So naming a beginning in these post-war years now offers something useful that wasn't necessary in the antebellum years. The political climate of the post-war years is emphatically different. And it offers the chance to name a beginning which then stands in for a movement, and it argues that the movement is very long-lived, right? That it underscores the postponement of women's demands, which is starting to happen in the post-war years, and women are furious about this. And it argues that these demands that are made are now 20 years old. They are not new. And it argues then that these demands are urgent in the post-war climate, right? It's a way of arguing for the urgency of women's rights. That suffragists, including Stanton's, began their movement here in 1850 and they commemorate in 1870 reveals, I think, how fungible the question of beginning still was. This was a very fluid question. So how and why, then, did this story of beginnings, first anchored in 1850, shift to 1848? The answer here has to do with my second point, and that is the second context, the politics within the movement itself. Intra-movement strife pushed Stanton and Anthony in particular to begin to move away from 1850 as a beginning and toward 1848. So if Stanton argued in 1870 that, and I quote her again here, the movement in England as in America may be dated from the first national convention held at Worcester, she doesn't argue that for very long. In 1873, Stanton and Anthony staged the second commemorative convention that suffragists ever held. And this time, it's for the 25th anniversary of Seneca Falls. It, like the 1870 event, argues vociferously for women's rights as really the most important movement that humanity has ever inaugurated. And it will do a whole variety of things to continue to take aim at that abolitionist narrative. So in that sense, this convention is very similar to the one in 1870. But here, they relocate and annotate the origins point of the movement. And they did so, I argue, to wield memory as a tool inside the movement, as well as outside the movement. 1848 is necessary for internal politics to the movement. As some of you who know the story know, by 1873, politics within the suffrage movement was incredibly chaotic the year that they hold this convention. And I'll talk about this in two ways. And the first is familiar to many people, and it's the famous split over the 15th Amendment. And that history went something like this. After the American Civil War, the Feminist Abolitionist Coalition reorganizes as the American Equal Rights Association. They form in 1866, and they're dedicated to two goals: enfranchisement for black men and for women, black and white. Then they're faced with a dilemma, the AERA, the American Equal Rights Association, in 1869 when Congress passes the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment would enfranchise freed men, but not women. So is this an important partial victory, or is it really insufficient and therefore ought to be opposed? And that debate starts to rack the 1869 American Equal Rights Association annual meeting. And very famously, Stanton and Anthony come out in opposition to the 15th Amendment in very ugly racist terms. They denounce black men as ignorant sambos and a variety of other things. And they decide in the end to break with the organization. And they go off and they form, somewhat in secret, a new organization known as the National Woman Suffrage Association. And just to sort of keep all the players here clear, I sort of put up, here we have Stanton and Anthony forming the National. Meanwhile, a bunch of other people who were also, long-lived antebellum activists who were organized in the American Equal Rights Association support the 15th Amendment. The vast majority of the American Equal Rights Association supports the 15th Amendment. But nonetheless, the organization can't really survive this cataclysm in 1869. And so the people who support the 15th Amendment but still also support women's suffrage reorganize in a different organization. And those, most famously, is Lucy Stone and her allies form the American Woman Suffrage Association. And then in a chapter that's very, very unknown and very little known, in 1870, there is an intense effort to try to merge the two organizations. It's not clear in 1869 that the split's going to last. There's a huge demand within the movement for unification. But that fails right in the summer of 1870. And it becomes clear in the summer of 1870 that this split is going to be lasting. Right after that, what takes place? The 1870 convention at the second decade convention commemorating Worcester. And in face of this new permanent split, all the American Association folks boycott the second decade convention. They refuse to show up. Now, this is particularly ironic because the American folks were the ones who were at the original convention. Lucy Stone was at the convention in 1850, as were most of the people aligned with the American Association. Interestingly, Stanton and Anthony were not there. They were not at the 1850 event, yet they're the ones who take the stage to commemorate it. Anthony wasn't even in the movement yet at this point. Nonetheless, she's commemorating a moment. And this split, I argue, is the main factor in why Stanton and Anthony move away from 1850 and move toward 1848. It's not the main factor in why they pinpoint beginnings. That has to do with the larger memory culture, but it is the main factor in which beginning they choose. 1850, if you think about it, draws a line, because all of the American Association folks had been there, it draws a line of succession to the American Association. They are supposedly, therefore, on the right side of history, right? They're bringing forward an antebellum tradition. They're simply the representatives of an antebellum tradition, and so whatever choices they make are the ones that should be seen on the right side of history. And by implication, Stanton and Anthony are not. They break from that history, right, by going off and forming the National. And remember, a lot of people think Stanton and Anthony are in the wrong in this time period. They have a lot of opposition against them. 1848, on the other hand, works much better for Stanton and Anthony as an origins point. It draws a line of historical succession to the National Association instead, because AWSA, or the American folks, had not been at the 1848 convention, because it was a local, spontaneous convention. Stone and many others were long-lived activists in the antebellum decades, but they hadn't been at Seneca Falls simply because it was this local, spontaneous convention that very few people outside of the area knew about. And this narrowness of who was at Seneca Falls was precisely its attractiveness to Stanton and Anthony. 1848, unlike 1850, argued for Stanton and Anthony as the rightful heirs of antebellum organizing. It put them on the right side of history, and it argued, therefore, that they were right in opposing the 15th Amendment. They continued to be on the right side of history. Now, you're probably thinking here that Anthony not being at Seneca Falls was kind of a problem, and you're exactly right. But in various ways throughout the 19th century, ways that I can't go into here today, Stanton and Anthony, as they create this Seneca Falls story, fold Anthony into the narrative, even though she hadn't been there. So that over the 19th century, Seneca Falls becomes as much Anthony's story as it is Stanton's. And so my tour guide's struggle to place her there is a natural outgrowth, really, of the ways Stanton and Anthony themselves constructed a Seneca Falls story. And plenty of people, I'm sure you may have heard, mistakenly place Anthony at Seneca Falls, and that's a process, I argue, that began with Stanton and Anthony themselves. But for our purposes here today, I want to stay focused just on the birth of this 1848 memory. So if national-level suffrage organizing forces, if the split in national suffrage organizing forces was one important internal dynamic that was going on, there was another important internal dynamic that went on that led to Stanton and Anthony wanting to emphasize 1848. And that was the rush of new recruits into the movement after the American Civil War. And I detail this at length in my book, but in essence, the movement was flooded with new recruits after the Civil War. And many of those new recruits felt that they could lead, and in fact, many of them did lead. They just resisted or ignored older veterans in a kind of classic generational conflict that social movements often have. This infuriated Anthony in particular, who believed that her own leadership was critical to success. And I think this is a point that we don't understand very well about the suffrage movement, that Stanton and Anthony were by no means in charge in the 1870s. Yet we often depict them in such as histories as if they were in charge, and I think that's largely because of the eventual triumph of a Seneca Falls narrative. It depicts them in charge, a Seneca Falls narrative does, from the founding forward. But they most emphatically were not. They were embattled, both with antebellum allies and with newcomers into the movement. And they were struggling throughout the 1870s, really throughout the second half of the 19th century, to gain a foothold and to garner attention. So an 1848 story highlighted them and helped them argue for their own historical significance. In 1873, then, that anniversary, without needing to resort to outright exclusion, nonetheless acted as a really useful historical sieve. It kept offstage newcomers, because they weren't there at the 1848 moment. It kept offstage their rivals, like Lucy Stone and other people in the American. And it drew attention to Stanton and Anthony, and it modeled reverence and deference to the pair, which they believed was a very important lesson for young recruits to learn. And all of these elements are going to become very important elements of a Seneca Falls mythology as it develops. But as commemorative events go, and by the standards of post-Civil War pageantry, which was considerable, this first anniversary celebration is actually fairly meager in ceremonial display, underscoring, I think, just how tentative this new point of origins was. Not yet a sacred myth in 1873, Seneca Falls was not yet even a story. And that's evident throughout the 1873 anniversary. Decorations are sparse. There's a wreath on the stage with a silver thread to represent the 25th anniversary. And other than that, there are no holy relics from 1848. The report from the convention in 1848, the original hadn't even survived. And the only physical tie to the convention itself were the original founders who sat on the stage. Three of the five were there: Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and Mott's sister, Martha Coffin Wright. Unable to reminisce, Anthony presides. She takes the role of an onstage historian, imbuing events she did not witness with retrospective significance. And this role of presiding over the creation of the story of Seneca Falls is something Anthony will do again and again and again. She opens, Anthony does, by announcing that they had there gathered to celebrate, quote, the 25th anniversary of the movement. She then reads from the printed report of the Seneca Falls Convention, and she explains what had happened there that day, who had been there, what had been discussed. And she has to do all this because most people in the audience aren't familiar with Seneca Falls. It wasn't a story that people knew. She's reading from a report of the convention, and this is interesting because one wonders, what's the history of that document she has in your hand? And only a few years earlier, getting one's hands on a reprint of the 1848 convention would have been nearly impossible. The original, which is here on the what would be your left-hand side, it was printed in a very small run by Frederick Douglass's North Star newspaper in Rochester. And the original disappeared. It probably was left somewhere on the cutting room floor of Douglass's North Star newspapers. And in 1868, just a few years before this commemoration begins, a contemporary remarks that the proceedings are, quote, now rare and will one day be hunted for by antiquarians. And indeed, today, fewer than 25 copies of the original survive. It's simply a document that didn't have a very robust life until 1870. And in 1870, in the wake of the split, Stanton has the proceedings reprinted. And that's the copy that's here on your right, or on, I guess on your, yeah, on your right. And once these start to circulate en masse. They print tons and tons and tons of them in the 1870s. And they start to encourage women to acquire the proceedings, to read the proceedings, learn about the story, and to adopt it as their own. And this happens over and over again at the 1873 convention itself, and I won't go into the details of that, but you can find that in the pages of my book. So together with Stanton's decision to reprint the report, various women stand up at the convention and urge other women there and elsewhere to get their hands on a copy of this. And it begins a process of turning this report into a kind of sacred text. And so in the end, I argue, the 1873 commemoration was less actually about preserving history than it was about creating a collective memory that drew a very clear line of succession. And that line of succession was made very explicit in resolutions that were proposed at the convention. Resolved, I quote here, that Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton will be held in grateful remembrance as the pioneers in this grandest reform of the age, that as the wrongs they attacked there were broader and deeper than any other, which is, of course, a jab at abolitionism, so as time passes, they will be revered as the foremost benefactors of the race, and that we will hold sacred their memory of their co-labors in the convention of 1848. And again, this is worded here in the future tense, right? They're looking forward, not backward. As would become a regular feature of the story as it developed, you'll notice that Martha Coffin Wright, who was on the stage there, has dropped from the resolution. Nobody asks that they remember her. And this will become a routine feature of the story as it develops. It will narrow on to the story of Stanton and Mott. And for her part, Lucretia Mott was there. She was 80 years old when the 1873 convention took place, and she wondered aloud from the stage of the convention whether this might be her last convention. It wasn't, but that point weighed heavily. She was clearly on her way out. And the torch was thus all but passed to Stanton evermore. A much younger woman. Interestingly, it's important to point out here that Lucretia Mott never pinpoints Seneca Falls as the beginning of women's rights, ever, at least in the surviving documents that we have. She always deflects a Seneca Falls story and puts emphasis on the importance of the Quakers and on women's early oratory, which would be the Grimkes and others. She does not celebrate Seneca Falls, even from the stage of the 1873 commemoration. Yet, she becomes kind of the godmother of Seneca Falls in the way that that story is created, and in a way that then passes the torch to Stanton and says that she is the new kind of empress of the movement in a way that vindicates her in the present. So we've looked at the two really important contexts, I think, for the birth of a need to pinpoint a beginning, which is the memory culture. And then secondly, 1848 specifically resulting from politics within the movement itself. And I want to just say in conclusion a few things about how I think Seneca Falls works. So let me underscore here one of my main arguments about the consequences of a Seneca Falls mythology. I think in drawing Stanton and Anthony as authoritative in these years, as histories often do, the story is often narrated from a Stanton and Anthony point of view. It's true in Ellen Du Bois's work. It's true in a variety of other books. I think we've actually read the end back onto the beginning, mistakenly. We've taken Seneca Falls as evidence of their centrality, as a kind of given about their centrality, rather than seeing Seneca Falls as an argument for that centrality. an argument that they spent the whole of the post-war decades constructing, against, I would add, considerable opposition. Seneca Falls, then, in essence, I think, was a strategy for creating and constructing their leadership. Stanton and Anthony are arguably the greatest women's historians of the 19th century. They will go on, as I detail in my book, to author a massive participant history of the movement. Here you see two volumes of an ultimate three and then ultimate six volume account of the movement called The History of Woman Suffrage. Stanton and Anthony will hold all of the commemorative conventions, nearly all of the commemorative conventions to take place in the post-war years, including the massive International Council of Women in 1888 for the 40th anniversary of Seneca Falls, by which point I argue the myth is starting to reach maturity. Yet, the historical work of these two women, which occupied really the bulk of their post-war careers, is something we almost never factor into an understanding of the two women. But it is absolutely central, I would argue, to understanding their careers. They understood that using history could be a powerful political tool, and they strove to do so. And although 1848 as an origin was a clear and consistent strategy for Stanton and Anthony, I want to say here that they were also human enough not to realize that they were attempting to draw Stanton's personal story, 1848 was really her personal story, onto the movement as a whole. This was not crass calculation on their part. This was not conniving Machiavellianism. This was truth to them. It was Stanton's truth. And each were arrogant enough, I think, to believe that others needed to accept this truth, that victory depended on it. This wasn't just a kind of self-congratulatory. They believed that victory in the movement depended on following their strategies. They believed they had the best strategies. And here I think we haven't spent enough time thinking about the kind of ambition and arrogance that Stanton and Anthony had, because they're not traits that we easily reconcile with 19th century women's political actors. We want them to be kind of magnanimous and wonderful and heroic, when in fact they were as messy as all politicians are. And they were quite arrogant in their sense that women really did need to follow them at a time when most women were arguing they didn't want to. And at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that Stanton and Anthony shared a righteous belief of that the story of women's rights was historically significant in a larger memory climate that did not treat women's history as worth recording or celebrating. And this is to their credit, right? I mean, they understood that recording and celebrating history could serve as an important movement resource. And their rivals never do. Lucy Stone and the American Association always resist this kind of writing of history that Stanton and Anthony pioneer throughout the second half of the 19th century. And in some ways, Stanton and Anthony uniquely understand this. And so in some ways, they're also able to imprint their version over other versions. So in a sense, they offered a movement an incredibly precious gift, a gift that we still cherish. But in many ways, this is also, I would just say in ways that we cherish it. Of course, here in Western New York, we have the Seneca Falls National Women's Rights Park, right? This story has been used to wield resources to garner, to use in the celebration of women's history, which is a pretty still difficult political act in this political climate, right, to get resources dedicated to commemorating women's history. Hillary Clinton tweeted 2 years ago that Seneca Falls, she's tweeted on the anniversary of Seneca Falls, that it represented the unfinished business of the 21st century. So Seneca Falls still circulates in really powerful ways. But it was both a gift and a directive, and I think it's the ways in which it's a directive that we've lost track of that. And it's on that point that I want to close, on this emphasis of the kind of very mixed legacy of Seneca Falls. If it's been a gift, it's also been a handicap. Put another way, it's meant to narrow and sift our understanding in ways that I think continue. We don't have yet a full and complex history of 19th century women's rights as it existed, certainly not in the post-war era. The still classic text for post-war women's rights, the post-war suffrage movement, was written in 1978. It's Ellen Du Bois's Feminism and Suffrage, for those of you who know it. We don't have a very robust history of this period after the Civil War. And this is partly, I've argued, because we haven't had a history of the story's organizing principle, the myth of Seneca Falls. And I would refer here back to my intro and when I was talking about the purposes of an origins narrative. If origins narratives work to legitimate and unify messy contingencies, if they make the outcome of a story seem unmanipulated, if they promote the forgetting of the struggles within the struggle, and if they promote the forgetting of debates and rivalries within the movement itself, then I would argue that those are still operational. The myth of Seneca Falls is still functioning in that way. It is still leading us not to understand how Seneca Falls was a strategy of Stanton and Anthony's and not a reflection of their excellence and their leadership, but a strategy for their leadership, which was never assured until the end of the 19th century. And that, I would argue, continues today precisely because I think we haven't attended closely enough to the power of this myth. And I think we would do well to grapple with that mixed legacy as we try to figure out how to advance a 21st century agenda for women's rights and the role of Seneca Falls within it. Thanks.